Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Need Some Introduction. In today's episode, I will be breaking down the first 6 episodes of 8 of the Apple TV Plus series Sugar, starring Colin Farrell, a series that, as advertised and up until this point, has presented itself as a modern, sun-drenched LA noir, and now with its big reveal, has become a different type of show. Why have a reveal this late in the season? Does this make the series more compelling, less compelling? Are you more likely to come in for a season 2? I have many questions about that. And if you have been watching this series, how will your appreciation of it change with this plot development? And if you've been waiting on the sidelines for the big reveal to see if you want to dip back into the show or start to binge it, well, I'll give you my opinion. But I'll set up the series for those of you who are behind on it when we get to that part of the episode. But before then, I have a spoiler-free review of the first big summer blockbuster of the season, The Fall Guy. So my nutshell review is, this is a fun movie. You should go see it. It'll probably be very successful. Okay, I got a little more than that to say. But honestly, I think you're going to hear that general opinion from the general audience many, many times. Some context setting first. The Fall Guy is directed by David Leitch, who began his career as a stunt double for Brad Pitt. A stunt double for a blonde star? Maybe related somewhere to this particular film? Given that fact, you may think that he has a terrible relationship with Brad Pitt, but actually has just directed him in his previous film, his most recent film, Bullet Train. But beginning as a stunt performer and then becoming a stunt coordinator for many of the films he worked on, he eventually produced, and it's believed that he was a co-director, although uncredited, on the first John Wick film. And John Wick in general brought a new awareness into a public discourse of the place of the stuntman in films, really centered their work, and really began a conversation of having stunt performers as Academy Award nominees, for example, something that we will probably see in the not-too-distant future. And once again, something that is referenced directly in this film. After his uncredited work on John Wick, he actually started a very successful directing career, first making the underseen, and I highly recommend this film, Atomic Blonde. We actually see scenes of the stunts in that film here in a montage early on that references the difficult and compelling work of stunt workers. And that film was supposed to be a female-centered Bond, Bourne, Wick-type franchise for Charlize Theron. That hasn't panned out, but it was a modest success. And as I mentioned, the stunt work in that film is exceptional. I really do highly recommend that film. The plot, really, I don't even know what's happening there at the end. It's a little confusing, a little too much spy work going on there at the end of that film. But for me, a thrilling watch. He followed that up with the massively successful Deadpool 2, a film I did not appreciate as much. And as a matter of fact, in general with his style, the more cartoonish and computer-aided and over-the-top the stunt sequences are in these films, really the less I appreciate them. But most audiences disagreed, and this was a massively successful sequel. He had also done significant work on the first Deadpool film. And then just 1 year later, he followed that up with the Fast and Furious spinoff Hobbs and Shaw. That film definitely goes into the cartoonish realm of action that I don't appreciate as much. However, I have to say, I really did enjoy that film. I like the chemistry between all the leads. And it's far from perfect, but I find it much more entertaining than the 2 most recent Fast and Furious films, for example. And once again, that was a massive box office success. He followed that up with Bullet Train, reuniting with Brad Pitt, and still perhaps dampened slightly by the pandemic. The film was a success, but was expected to gross a little bit more than it did. And once again, I thought this overly cartoonish style and the CGI-assisted stunt work didn't really work for me. I kind of got bored with that film as I was watching it. But in general, he's able to get solid performances from his cast across the board with all of these films, along with the Wick films, which he helped kickoff, a real focus on making the stunt work really pop, and something which is oftentimes very difficult, making action and violence and comedy all tonally blend. And I think he does a great job of that, not only on most of the films that I've mentioned here so far, but for my money, The Fall Guy, this current film, is his best achievement at pulling all of this off. And in no small part for the utter charming lead performance of Ryan Gosling. Gosling has had quite an interesting career in the fact that he kicked off his career as young Hercules, played one of the football players in Remember the Titans. This is all the way back in 2000. But even all the way back then, had a desire to stretch his acting abilities. And I find him to be really charismatic in his goofy mode and as well as in his more brooding mode. And in 2001, he made an excellent film called The Believer. I should say the film isn't excellent. It's based on a true story. This neo-Nazi who commits terrorist acts against Jewish religious establishments and Jewish people, who is actually part Jewish and has this inner conflict that the film actually isn't quite up to the task to fully explore, but Gosling's performance is really compelling in the center of this film. So it gives a really great performance here, and I do recommend it for that reason, if for no other, although the film overall is still solid. But then he tried to do the Hollywood thing. He made The Notebook a phenomenally successful, especially at home video, romance, which made him a heartthrob to a whole generation of young women. But then he immediately pivoted away from that rather than capitalizing on it. He gave an excellent performance in a film called Half Nelson, in which he plays a drug-addled teacher in an inner-city school, which got him his first Academy Award nomination. He tried to be in a Hollywood thriller Fracture with Anthony Hopkins, not a success. And then he made some strange choices from that point on, really avoiding the stereotypical Hollywood path. He played a man in love with his sex doll in Lars and the Real Girl. He was in Blue Valentine, a very emotionally raw film about the breakdown of a marriage with excellent performances. And then in 2011, he suddenly became very prolific and had quite a string of interesting different types of films. Not only did he have Crazy Stupid Love and had a very charming romance with Emma Stone, he also made the very dark film noir Drive, which is one of the classic modern crime films, if you haven't seen that one. He followed that up with an interesting performance in a film that I don't love, but a great performance on his part, The Place Beyond the Pines. Worked with Emma Stone again in Gangster Squad, not that successful. He turned up in the Academy Award nominated The Big Short, doing most of the narration there. And in 2016 had the 1-2 punch of La La Land, once again reuniting with Emma Stone, a massive success. And speaking of sun-drenched LA film noirs, appeared with Russell Crowe in Shane Black's film The Nice Guys. And if there's any corollary to really show the charm he shows here in The Fall Guy, this is really almost the same performance. And I do believe this is currently available on Apple TV to stream. Gosling really shows himself to be an incredible physical comedian in this film. And the chemistry between him and Russell Crowe is really terrific. Russell Crowe now is in a point in his career where he's basically doing campy performances and just whatever this is now 7 years ago. This film still shows that he still had full star wattage at this point in his career. So all that is to say, this is definitely a film that's been underseen. If you enjoyed The Fall Guy, you should definitely track this one down. And Crowe needs to be making some better casting decisions. Following up on La La Land, he once again leaned into darker material, at least in his performance anyway, Blade Runner 2049 and First Man. Neither one of those really showed off his comedic charisma, but in the Netflix film, The Gray Man, which we reviewed here on the podcast, that's a bloated mess of a film, but it is huge, and his charisma shines through even there. So I did like his performance in The Gray Man. But this renaissance of his career, which has really never disappeared, although he has disappears for years here and there, he has a family now, but he seems to be full bore leaning into becoming a huge movie star, starting with that Gray Man reemergence, but then of course playing Ken in Barbie a performance that even the detractors of that film appreciated and loved. And all of that set him up to potentially have a huge blockbuster, maybe even a franchise of his own. And maybe, just maybe, this is that film. The Fall Guy is actually based on the old Lee Majors television series. Lee Majors' character name in that series is Colt Seavers, and he drives the same type of truck that this contemporary version of the character does. And he's a private detective slash stuntman in that television series. I think it ran from 81 to mid-80s, maybe 86, 87 or so. There might have even been some follow-up films there. Pretty successful back in its day. I remember it. I watched this show. I was much younger at the time. I probably can't remember one particular episode or guest star or any aspect of it since I was pretty young at the time. There would be at least one big stunt sequence in each one of those episodes. And I love this idea of a stuntman PI. In the new film, Gosling doesn't actually play a PI. He plays a stuntman who, early on in the film, has a severe injury, is basically retired from stunt work. He usually works with Joni Moreno, played by Emily Blunt, who is an aspiring director. And we also meet the producer of the film where he's injured and has worked with him multiple times before, Gail, played by Hannah Waddingham, most recognizable from Ted Lasso. And Gosling plays the stunt double for Tom Ryder, played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who was entertaining in the Bullet Train Leech's previous film. He also has a buddy on set, played by Winston Duke. And as much as I enjoy the film overall, I would say if there's any criticism here, I would say you have Winston Duke, you have Emily Blunt, whose career basically in the past few years has been to rise above a weak character. She got an Academy Award nomination, elevating a generic wife role in Oppenheimer. And honestly, that is a memorable role and purely because of her performance. Similarly here, she brings a lot of charisma, a lot of romance. The biggest jokes come from her public interactions with Gosling. And yet she is so underused in the film as just a motivator, a trigger to bring Colt out of retirement. And the same goes for Winston Duke. I feel you really underuse that actor as well in just this friend, sidekick character. Aaron Taylor-Johnson also gets relatively little screen time, but is very entertaining as this self-obsessed movie star. But this is the Ryan Gosling show. He is in every scene of this film, and he carries this whole entire film, and it is a blast. It is so much fun to watch this film. The screenplay is very funny, very well performed. The stunts, for the most part, are very convincing. You actually see many of them, the behind-the-scenes footage of the stunts being done in the credit sequence. And this is probably my favorite of Lynch's films to this point. The basic premise of the film, as I mentioned, Colt Seavers injured very early in the film, pulling off a stunt, breaks his back. We discover also that this flirtation he has with Jody has actually gone beyond that. But after he was injured, he disappeared. He ghosted her and also disappeared from stunt work. And when we meet him again, he is parking cars in Los Angeles and is called out of retirement by Gail, Hannah Waddingham's character, supposedly because Jody is now directing her dream sci-fi epic, a very funny caricature of these type of films, which appears to basically be a blend of Mad Max and Cowboys versus Aliens. And if that sounds terrible, that movie would probably be a terrible flop. Sorry, Jody, your film's going to flop. But it turns out Jody has not requested him on set. As a matter of fact, she's not very happy to see him. He's actually there because Tom Ryder, the actual star of the film, has disappeared. And now he has to go into PI mode, stunt man by day, PI by night. And probably about 20 minutes into the film, I was like, I have a feeling this title has more than one significance here in the film. All I'll say is that there are some twists in the plot, and luckily the most obvious ones actually pay off about halfway through. So then I'm really thinking, oh, okay, so how does this go on from this point? And it resolved itself very nicely. If there's a weak point in the script, it's definitely the finale, the big escalating action sequence. it almost feels like the pacing of a Marvel film where the last 20 minutes are just action after action, and the tightness of the plotting, the escalation of the action gets redundant rather than really feeling like it is the best stunt work we see in the film. But all that being said, despite those weaknesses, it is still incredibly entertaining. And once again, really, this is the Ryan Gosling show, and he does an incredible job of carrying the entire film. And this is predicted to open in the $40 million range this weekend. Maybe strong word of mouth will push it up higher, but I have a feeling this thing could get really big if some of these other early summer titles flop. This might be something that legs out over the course of the summer and could be a big box office performance, especially riding the goodwill that people already have from the Barbie film. That film made $1.5 billion, so just a percentage of that would make this one of the biggest movies of the year. Another critique I have here is I did not watch the trailer for this film until after I saw it. I've tried to avoid that for the most part. I've seen snippets of it, you know, watching sporting events. You'll have those like 15-second teasers, but I never watched the trailer, and if there was an extended trailer, I would basically walk away from the screen. So I'd seen little flashes of action sequences, even in those shorter trailers, but I was really surprised to see the trailer all the way through after seeing the film, and I do not recommend you watch this trailer if you haven't watched it yet or if you've forgotten it along the way. They give away big plot details, even some of the twists you can guess from looking at the trailer. And all of the action sequences, including the final ones, are all spoiled right in the trailer. You don't know they're spoiled until you walk into the theater. But once you're in the theater, you're like, oh, I know what's going to happen next because I saw it in the trailer. And we haven't seen that sequence before, so I know how this movie ends. So as is often the case with a lot of these films, avoid the trailer. It's usually probably a good rule of thumb. And there is nothing deep. There's no subtext here. This is just an absolute blast. Not a bad way to start off the summer. And if there's any cultural significance to what we see here in the film, maybe just to call out explicitly multiple times how stuntmen are so valuable to the making of these films and how underappreciated they are, because we're supposed to believe that the actors are doing this work. So their job is to disappear. And in so doing, their job so well, they're forgotten. So let's give it to the stuntmen. Let's give them their own category at the Academy Awards minimally. I also find it very funny that we have someone, the director, David Leitch, who is making a film in which this blonde, egomaniacal star is actually stunt doubled by this put upon victimized stuntman who is as slapstick as he is, actually very clever at being able to survive and get himself out of these circumstances very adeptly. And of course, the superstar is a total schmuck and a totally unlikable person, although in a very funny way, Aaron Taylor Johnson giving a very funny performance. And if we want to correlate that to, was this his relationship with Brad Pitt? Once again, you could read that, and maybe some people will read that into the film, except for the fact that, of course, Pitt just worked with him on his last film. Makes it seem like this is maybe a very intentional but playful ribbing against his friend rather than like some kind of expose of the true nature of Brad Pitt's movie stardom. So once again, that's The Fall Guy. It's available everywhere this weekend, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Don't expect anything more than that. One more interesting point to note here is that this is the first time in many years where the summer season is not being kicked off by a Marvel film. I mean, we can go all the way back to the Spider-Man films, and definitely since 2009 when that summer season was kicked off by Iron Man, and nearly every year for almost 20 years, if not more, the summer movie season was kicked off by a Marvel film. And that extends all the way to last year where Guardians of the Galaxy kicked off the summer season and was a huge hit, by the way, even though Marvel's struggling, especially on a TV side. Some of these series are not hitting. Some of the films have flopped. I mean, the Marvels was a complete disaster financially. Although I actually thought it not a mildly fun film, but do not spend $200 million on a film that's just going to be forgotten within 15 minutes. My 2 cents right there. But even last summer, Guardians of the Galaxy, a huge hit for them, kicking off the summer, early May. And this is the first time, just kind of exemplifying where Marvel is at right now, that they do not kick off the summer this year. They have only one film this summer, which is going to be the Deadpool film, which may very well be the biggest film of the year. But just the fact that they didn't move Deadpool into this slot, Deadpool and Wolverine, makes me wonder about how they feel about the health of the franchise and what their intentions are there. That's going to be a very interesting moment, by the way. I think they're going to use that as a way to not only introduce the X-Men, but to reset a lot of things about the current plans for their films. So that's an interesting conversation to have at that point. But just the fact that we are not kicking off the summer season with a Marvel film in and of itself is an indicator of where Marvel's at right now. I do think they plan to go back into that routine starting next year, but that all remains to be seen on how the Deadpool Wolverine movie does and how these films continue to shape up. They are really struggling right now. But in the meantime, maybe the Fall Guy can take that opportunity and ride out the summer and become one of the bigger hits of the year. I bet you it'll be one of the more entertaining films this year, so maybe people will go back to it if they start feeling disappointed with some of the other products. That all remains to be seen, and maybe I'll be checking in on the summer box office performance as the year progresses. Okay, on to Sugar. I've been looking forward to this series for almost a year now. It was on the calendar, announced that it would probably be out last year in the spring. I believe it was pushed back maybe because of some production issues. There might have been. There does seem to be, with the runtime of some of the episodes, with the change of the showrunner being removed from some of the episodes as the writer and just as a producer, maybe the show needed to have a lot of post-production. Then its premiere date then got moved to the fall. Then came the writer's strike and it got delayed again. And now here it comes kind of unceremoniously for something that seems to have this pedigree. Supposedly this script was floating around Hollywood. It was a very hot script. I would assume from watching this film that this was probably a movie script. And this is a big problem with many of the series I see now, my personal opinion, that a lot of these scripts should have been movies and they get extended into series. And that makes the shape of it, of the season, of the story, exposition, wrong. Wrong for a season of television, basically. And I have to say, this happens a lot with Apple TV. It seems like they take book adaptations or movie adaptations and then turn them into series. And oftentimes, they have made an intentional decision or plan to focus on setting up a season two rather than delivering a satisfying season one. And also oftentimes in the context of science fiction, that they have a lot of these science fiction series that aren't satisfying in and of themselves. I actually think that they did a great job with For All Mankind. Season one is very satisfying, has a great ending, but it takes a long time to get to that moment. Maybe speaking to the fact that this is almost a movie script that is extended. But in that regard, that one works because the more invested you are in those characters, the more the payoff is at the end of that season. But I compare that to Silo, a season of television that I didn't really like that much, to be honest, although I covered it here on a podcast. And mostly because having read the book, all the really interesting things that are going to happen to those characters in that story are happening in the first book, but beyond the end of the season. So intentionally ending the season in a place where they're like, oh, the cool stuff is coming next season. And I find that to be almost a tease. It really doesn't satisfy me as a viewer. And I haven't seen the end of this season of television yet, but I feel like this is another example of that. So Colin Farrell is somebody who's been around for decades now, who I did not appreciate as a movie star when he was the next big thing. He was in Minority Report. I love that movie, but I felt he was so hammy in the role, maybe because he was trying to mask his accent. And he definitely had charisma, but as a performer, I felt him to be an overactor. This is the same issue I used to have with Brad Pitt. I feel like Brad Pitt's really grown into, or maybe aged into, his skill as an actor and maybe just his impersonally. He's become a much more interesting actor over time. And at the time, both of these characters were the hot new thing, handsome, charismatic, but not convincing to me as characters on screen. They were just themselves in an annoying way. But I have completely come around on Farrell. He now is someone I will show up for. Even if the film is not good, I will go see it for his performance. And honestly, oftentimes not in his Hollywood films where he's the leading man. Films like The Winter's Tale, terrible, and Total Recall. This is still a decade ago at this point. But when he does a comedic role like he did in Horrible Bosses, terrific performance there. But even more so when he started to take more character-driven roles and lets the comedy emerge in the things he doesn't say, in the spaces in between his dialogue. It's a really unique talent, and he's so good at it. And I specifically call out, for example, a film like The Lobster, which is an absolutely brilliant film if you haven't seen that. And even more recently, After Yang, an absolutely heartbreaking and wonderful science fiction film from a few years ago, all the way through to his Academy Award-nominated performance in The Banshees of Inisherin, definitely, hands down, one of the absolute best performances of that year, if not multiple years, in this clueless, naive, and sensitive performance. It's a real surprising turn for him, and that he can embody all these very different characters. That same year, he was unrecognizable under layers of makeup playing the Penguin in the Batman movie, which he's also has the Penguin series is coming later this year, so maybe something we'll cover here on the podcast. All this is to say that he's a chameleon now. He gives very interesting character performances, and he seems to be tapping into something deeper within himself. So I make appointments to see Colin Farrell in things. Here he is, dapper, styled up, a film noir. I love film noirs. Set in Los Angeles, I like this Hollywood-adjacent film noir genre in general. So all this is to say, this was made for me. I'm on board with him in this role, in this genre. Awesome. Give me more of that. And what I found up until this point is that I have not enjoyed this season of TV, and I've simply been watching it to get to the point when I know what the twist is, which is honestly not the way you should be framing a season of TV. And maybe they've done this because they know that their strategy of making a compelling mystery show and then having a twist in it didn't pan out. Maybe that was their intention. It just didn't work out that way. Because the mystery has not been interesting until this point. And not only that, there's so little confidence in the storytelling of that mystery that every single episode of the show has had a little wink that there's more going on here. Why does he keep looking at the moon? Why can he drink so much alcohol? Why can he pick somebody up off the ground with one hand? So there's always these hints that there is something else going on. So even as the mystery itself not only is not compelling, we don't even know what we're supposed to be paying attention to in the context of that film noir-like plot. We've just been strung along and strung along for this big reveal. So the question is, after you wait through 5-6 episodes practically of a season of television, how satisfying is it to put the reveal in this late in the game? Colin Farrell is not only a star here of the series, but also one of the producers, and the show is created by Mark Protosevich, who's mostly a screenwriter for films, including The Cell, I Am Legend, and the pretty terrible remake of Old Boy, the one directed by Spike Lee. So many of his films have a sci-fi bent, which was probably the first clue as to the twist that the season might go into. Also, for a series that presents itself as a pretty straightforward noir, the title sequence, specifically the music choice, is a little trippy, to say the least. When the series begins, Colin's character, John Sugar, is in Japan. The series, as many film noirs are wont to do, is shot in black and white at the beginning, although color comes in over the course of this episode. And the director of this first episode, an episode called Olivia, is Fernando Moraes, the Brazilian director of films like City of God, The Constant Gardener, Blindness, but has also directed television, including episodes of The Sympathizer, which is currently on the air as well. And it turns out that Farrell's character is here to rescue a girl who's been kidnapped. During a knife fight, he's actually injured, and he says he doesn't like to hurt people. This entire series is narrated by Farrell, as is often the case with these film noirs. And he does continuously say that he does not like hurting people. And he kind of does go out of his way of hurting people most of the time. He actually is very sweet, appropriate to his name. The father of this abducted girl appears to be a gangster. I forgot to mention, of course, that Sugar speaks Japanese fluently and actually speaks multiple languages fluently here in the course of the season. There are many references made here that he is here to observe, not to intercede. And perhaps being a PI is a perfect way to observe human behavior. But once again, who would be so concerned with this mission of observing human behavior? When he returns to Los Angeles, he speaks Arabic to his driver and tries to help him as well. He's on to his potential next case, and we see him have an episode. His hand starts to tremble, something that happens to him repeatedly over the course of the season. But he's able to compose himself. And this is when he meets Ruby, or when we meet Ruby, his handler, played by the actress Kirby. She seems to have real concern for him. She apparently does not want to send him on this mission, and yet seems to be baiting him exactly into this circumstance. She's received a call from a famous Hollywood producer, played by James Cromwell, and his granddaughter is missing. Apparently, the girl has disappeared multiple times. She's 25. She's not a teenager anymore, but still one of the younger family members. And he's worried about her this time. She seemed concerned the last time he saw her. She has run away before, but not like this. And Sugar immediately bonds to her when he sees a picture of her, reminds him of someone else that he lost. And we discover over the course of the series that that is his sister. I forgot to mention that he subscribes to all the movie magazines, the trade movie magazines. He references scenes from movies, dialogue, and we even see in the film itself shots from the films that are being referenced from other film noirs that have similar action actually inserted into this show itself. So definitely this paralleling of John's affection for cinema versus his actual occupation. He begins his investigation at Olivia's house. And her brother is there, who actually is a somewhat well-known actor who has a bad reputation in Hollywood. And apparently there's a big story about the break about him. And the first breadcrumb that continues the investigation, he finds some photographs taken with Amy Ryan, who was her stepmother. She's a former rock star, now professional alcoholic. And he goes to this rundown bar where the photograph was taken and befriends an unhoused person on the street, showing how kindly he is. He offers some money to the man, who he immediately says, "I know that you're a good person." And probably because he also has a very well taken care of dog. And we also find out that Sugar loves dogs. Is he a werewolf? He does seem to be fascinated by the full moon. The speculation continues. So this character, Melanie, played by Amy Ryan, happens to be at the bar at that very moment. And she starts drinking with Sugar. And he informs her, here's another breadcrumb for our investigation, that his metabolism is so fast he can process alcohol 60 times faster than other people. That's a very fast metabolism. And that means that Melanie gets very drunk while he stays stone sober. She also mentions, oh, I love sci-fi films. I think that's more than a clue. He leaves with Melanie and leaves his phone and his card with Carl, the unhoused man, on the street. And long story short, this poor guy is going to die eventually. And John's going to inherit his dog. Back at Melanie's house, she puts the moves on John, but John does not take the opportunity. She's drunk, or at least that's the excuse he gives. Later that night, in Olivia's car, he finds a body. And at the end of the episode, we find that in Olivia's bag, she has pictures of her mother, who passed away also in a car accident, in a compromising position. And suddenly, in the final moments of the episode, Sugar has an attack. He goes into the bathroom. He needs to inject himself with something. We see something strange happening where his mirror is not matching his reality. So what could possibly be happening here? And that's the mystery of the pilot episode of the show. So to the show's credit, it's not like it hasn't been teasing that there's something more going on here. It's not like they just blurred us into a completely conventional film noir and then pulled the rug on us. It's the fact that, if I had this main critique here, is that the actual noir mystery was not compelling in and of itself. And honestly, the reveal should have just come much sooner in the season. In episode 2, we find Sugar meeting up with Dennis Boutsakaris, playing Bernie Siegel, David and Olivia's father, also a Hollywood producer, And he apparently is suspicious of Sugar and does not want Olivia's disappearance investigated. He's very concerned that a sexual assault allegation against his son is going to derail his upcoming film release. From Olivia's GPS, he has seen multiple stops at an address in Los Angeles. A woman there had also disappeared, and she had had multiple altercations with this boyfriend of hers, who's a really bad guy, wanted for assault and rape, who, by the way, turns out to be the body in the trunk. Ruby continues to want Sugar off this case. Pretty much everybody wants him to stop this investigation. She says she's worried about his well-being, but there might be more to it than that, or there certainly is. He continues to bond with Melanie, explains to her that he's actually looking for Olivia, and later that night, tracking down his phone, he finds that Carl, the homeless man, has passed away, and this is where he inherits the dog. Returning to Olivia's car, he finds the body is now gone, but he finds a blonde hair, perhaps Melanie's. And meanwhile, we arrive at the Vasquez household, that woman who's been missing. Her sister is there with her children, and there's another bad hombre here, Stallings, played by Eric Lang. He seems to have some supernatural ability of telling when people are lying or not, but somehow does not recognize Amy Ryan's photograph, even though she's supposedly a famous person. Sugar shows up at this apartment as part of his investigation. He pretends to be a parole officer, pretends to set their truck on fire, and in a distraction, he escapes with the family and Melanie. Meanwhile, David Siegel, this son who has a story about to break, has his right-hand man hook up with an FBI agent, I believe he is, and coerce him into digging up some biographical information on John Sugar, and they find out where he grew up and who his mom is. Of course, John Sugar's ahead of all of them, and that's not really his mom, just somebody that this organization has set up in the role of the parent. So once again, a lot of role-playing, a lot of acting, some metaphor for being in the movie business. But once again, we don't even know if John Sugar actually has a family. Being questioned by John, Melanie does finally confess, or at least tell the story that she did see Olivia right before she disappeared, and she had the body in the trunk because she was helping her dispose of this killer who she had accidentally shot in self-defense. And a gun shows up here. She is apparently Bernie Siegel's current wife, but Bernie still has a very good relationship with Melanie, apparently, and they even meet behind John's back. John attends this party that he's been shirking for the past week or so, or at least complaining about attending, a polyglot society. All these people speak many different languages. This society is obviously not what it appears to be. It's really an excuse to have these agents, whatever they happen to be, meet together at Ruby's house. This is part of some psychological assessment that they're doing. And once again, Ruby warns him during his assessment that they're here to observe these people and not participate. She thinks he's getting too involved in this case. And at the end of this episode, we see that Ruby is actually deleting all records of the Stallings character from all the databases. So incredibly powerful that she has this ability to access to all these systems. But once again, why is she allowing John to do this investigation despite her protestations, allowing him to know this case is available for him, probably assuming that he'll be pursuing this, only to then try to throw a wrench in the works and even erasing this other person from the public record. So what is everybody hiding? We're halfway through this show, almost, and things are still unclear. Now, by the time we get to episode 4, now the show is really starting to spread very little action over its, granted, short running time. But these recaps, other than these meandering asides, could be one or two sentences long. In the opening scene here, another important clue, I would say, is that John Sugar goes to see a doctor, and he asks him, have you ever seen the movie The Thing? And then we see scenes from The Thing enacted, and then yet another reference here to some kind of alien invasion. Melanie, at this point, supposedly is continuing this investigation in good faith with John, and they eventually discover another woman who's been sexually assaulted by David Siegel. That night, they go to see a restoration of one of Jonathan Siegel's classic films. Sugar, while ingratiating himself with the security guard, is actually there to monitor everyone's activity when his back is turned. And he sees that Melanie is talking to Bernie, and they have a ugly confrontation. John notes that the woman in this classic film is dressed in the same dress that Olivia's mother was in those sexually explicit photographs. The news breaks that David has been accused of sexual assault. He's freaking out. Jonathan Siegel has a heart attack on stage, or just as he steps off stage. And we see Billings and his gang in his home. He has something locked behind a closed door. His secret project. In episode 5, we see that David is watching some dailies for this film that was about to come out. It was going to be his comeback vehicle. And a gun is mothering / smothering him. He's a good boy. Everything's going to work out. Sugar comes knocking, and after threatening everybody, I don't want to get violent, but I will if I have to. David suddenly decides to spill the beans on everything. He was always a spoiled kid. He always got what he wanted. Never really figured out how to talk to women. Had this expectation that he should just have this privilege. And had eventually intersected with Stallings, who provides women. In this case, they are sex trafficked. These aren't even prostitutes. And we actually see in the course of this episode, Stallings at work, smuggling people over the border and then separating the attractive women from the rest, these new candidates. So this guy's a really, really bad guy. And it turns out that David had mentioned that Olivia had been talking to some of these women and was about to go public with all of this and really wanted him to intimidate her. And then she disappeared. Perhaps I take him at face value that he never wanted it to get to this point. But here's where we're at. And for all we know, Olivia is still alive out there somewhere. Melanie's recording a new album, apparently. And in her conversations with her friend, I guess it's simply here to establish the fact that she truly is an honest broker and really does like John Sugar. This honestly feels like a reshoot just to establish that she's not running a game on him, because she did just one episode ago nefariously meet with her ex-husband. Ruby meets with this character, Miller. She's worried that Sugar is going to see some things that he doesn't want to see in this exploration, this investigation. And Miller tells Ruby to prevent that from happening, no matter the cost. That night, Melanie is visited by one of Stallings' goons and is just about to be captured, trapped inside of the bathroom, when Sugar, who has Charlie, his key investigation partner, stationed outside her home. They've both somehow missed that this guy is inside the house. He recognizes it just in time, gets in there, and beats this guy nearly to death. So we see this violent side of him, maybe most clearly for the first time. And as the episode ends, David decides to take this small pistol his mother has hidden in her jewelry box, and he shoots himself in the head, nearly fatally. Meanwhile, Melanie is staying with Sugar in his hotel room. He has trouble sleeping. They very explicitly do not have any kind of romantic connection here. She's even called it out earlier in the episode that that's not the kind of connection she feels to him. And when he decides to lie on the floor next to her that night, they're both awake. He tells her, "I have a secret," but he can't tell her. This is directly said to the audience. This is just dragging out the inevitable reveal, which comes finally at the very, very end of this current episode. All right. The first clue as to what the reveal is in the title of this episode 6, which is called Go Home. As soon as I saw that, I kind of knew what we were in for. It turns out David didn't actually successfully kill himself. However, he's basically brain dead. He couldn't deal with the shame and the embarrassment and the consequences of his actions that are to come. Billings gets a warning that Sugar's on the way. He's just returned from his latest foray to the border and is reuniting with his gang at his home. He gets the drop on Sugar, and Sugar says, "I don't want to have to hurt you. I understand the lure of violence." So speaking to the fact that he's had a violent past of his own. So maybe he's protesting too much when he says that he doesn't like to get violent. Maybe he just doesn't like enjoying it as much as he does. They're all laughing. "How are you going to get the upper hand on us?" And here's where the show has a first explicit supernatural twist. He's disarmed. He's warning them about what he's going to do to them. They're laughing. And when the first close-up gunshot is discharged, he blocks the bullet with his hand. I assume this is some kind of force field since his skin is not impervious. We'll find out over the course of this episode. And he starts killing everybody in the room. Makes the mistake of not killing the girlfriend, although he does give her a shot to the head by the end of this confrontation, because she comes back and stabs him in the guts with some very long blade she had somewhere in that gaming room they were in. But he doesn't kill Stallings. He has some questions for him. Looking at his phone, he realizes that it was Ruby, Ruby betrayed him and tipped off Stallings that sugar was on the way. And after torturing him a bit, shooting him in the arm, and Stallings continuing to attempt some retaliation, it starts to become apparent that he does not know where she is. And at that point, Sugar just kills him by shooting him in the head. Sugar shows his empathy for these dogs again that are caged in the garage and sees one especially sad one that he releases. That goon that they beat up, I think it's the same goon he beat up the night before, shows up. He's like, hey, 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 where are my peeps at? They're all dead. Sugar doesn't kill this guy, just says, well, I hope you don't betray me in the next scene. But lets him go anyway. Maybe not the best strategy. Then again, this guy appears to be nearly invincible. He is suffering pretty badly from that gut wound, though. We check in one more time with the seagulls. Bernie, actually, this is a pretty good scene. Bernie is talking to his dad, Jonathan, who, of course, hired Sugar and inadvertently triggered this suicide by his grandson. And Bernie talks about how he pampered the son, made him feel that everything was easy, and that rather than telling him, well, you know, that was a mistake. He's talking specifically about letting him play craps when he was underage. And he made a lot of money that night. And rather than telling him, well, that was very lucky, that's not always how it goes, he allowed his son to believe this was the way life was going to be. And maybe he made a mistake in coddling him a little too much. This is an interesting bit of dialogue here. It doesn't really thematically lead to anything here in the show, but I do want to call out that I thought it was a pretty interesting way for them to deal with this death of their son and grandson. I doubt there'll be any significant payoff here beyond this point. Now, honestly, we have about 10 minutes to go in the episode here, and this was really annoying to me, probably because I knew, and this is detrimental in a way, that the twist was coming at some point in this episode, and that even within the episode itself, it's almost as if they knew this context, which they obviously couldn't when they were putting the show together, but it is so dragged out here at the end. It's as if they are just trying to keep you on the hook for as long as possible. He returns to the hotel room. He's bleeding badly. Don't take me to the hospital. I can't go to the hospital, but here's somebody who can help me. It's this person who we saw him speaking to during that society meeting a couple episodes ago. He tells her, Melanie, you need to run back to CVS and get these other supplies, even though she had already come back with those exact same supplies. Really, it's just a ruse to get her out of the hotel room. And then something happens in the bathroom. He has some dark fluid that he's going to transfuse Sugar with. So something is happening in the bathroom. We don't see it. When Sugar awakes, it's later in the day. This guy's leaving the hotel room. Melanie's still with him. She asks him, what the hell is going on? And he says, I was going to ask you the same thing. He tells her to keep an eye on him, on Sugar, and not to let him leave. Of course, as soon as he wakes up in the middle of the night and Melanie's asleep, he gets up and leaves. He has to go see Ruby. Ruby, why did you betray me? Why did you tell Stallings that I was coming? And she says, I just wanted him to leave. I didn't want to set you up. I didn't want him to hurt you. And this scene is so frustrating. He basically says to her over and over again, why did you do this? Why did you do this? And she's like, I can't tell you. I can't tell you. I won't tell you. I can't tell you. It's really a useless scene. If she's not going to say anything, then why even have this scene or stage it this way? This was maybe the worst scene in the episode. Maybe the series up until this point. It really starts to feel like they are simply dragging the show out here. She offers him some aspirin. Even this is really clunky the way it's done. She's like, oh, I have to go upstairs and get the aspirin. He opens the drawer, sees the aspirin bottle right there. She could have at least pulled a different drawer open, by the way. And that's when he knows, oh, she went upstairs to rat me out. She had the aspirin right here all the time. So that useless trip, he heads back to the hotel room. I mean, if you haven't seen it, you really have to see this scene. It is 5 minutes of dialogue about absolutely nothing. Like nothing happens in this scene for 5 minutes. And we're waiting and waiting and waiting to find out what the hell is going on in the show. And when he gets back to the hotel room, he says, maybe today, just today, maybe I can go home. And what does that mean? It means he goes back into the bathroom, fills up a syringe, injects himself in the neck. Now, we saw this in the first episode, although in that scenario, I guess he was using the syringe that made him look human, because in this scenario, he takes that syringe and we see that he basically looks like a Skrull from Marvel. Now, if this is a crossover with the Marvel Universe, that would be quite a twist. That's the real twist. He is a blue-gray-skinned alien. That's right, everybody. The reason he looks at the moon, the reason that they talk about, hey, these people, like, wait a second, you're talking about those people, you're not a person? What does that mean? But no, he's not a vampire. No, he's not a werewolf. Although they've teased some of this, right? He gets a bag of blood when he's really about to die. He stares at the moon a lot. He has an affinity for dogs. So these people online who have been speculating, maybe it's a werewolf. Okay, I saw the clues there. I understand. But he's looking at the moon, possibly because he's an alien. And aliens look at the moon. Maybe it reminds him of the moon from his planet. Oh, who knows? But anyway, that's the twist. He's an alien. And now we got two episodes to deal with this fact. And we still don't know why Olivia's mother wore the dress that the grandfather used in his classic film. We still don't know why this organization has kidnapped Olivia. It's not apparently that Stallings was working purely to protect David, even though David believed that. It's actually this organization itself that has kidnapped Olivia. What does she know? If they're simply harvesting humans for investigation, for research, whatever it happens to be, then why pick somebody who's connected where things could blow back? Jonathan Siegel had reached out to this organization for this investigation. So assuming he would not be part of the kidnapping if he knew that the investigation would point back at him. So why has she been abducted? We still don't fundamentally even understand. Stallings obviously not the big bad for this season. He's dead now. It's very confusing. You see how all these storylines are coming together. I assume this is all going to pay off in the finale. Now, how satisfying is that payoff going to be? I don't know. And I got to tell you that this particular episode, and maybe episode 5 as well, that the dragging out of this reveal really started to try my patience. Okay, maybe there's still a reason to tell the story this way. But my feelings at this moment, and I'm open to being proven wrong, but in my opinion, this was a disastrous decision on their part. You have a series that directly references films of the 1940s and 50s, the film noirs of that time period, which of course were replaced by the paranoid sci-fi fantasies of the 1950s, oftentimes about body swapping, oftentimes about aliens hiding in plain sight or living among us because of the Red Scare in the 1950s and the paranoia around secret military operations, building nuclear weapons, for example. So this is the context for the paranoia of the science fiction movies of the 1950s. So why do I say all that? Wouldn't this series be more interesting if we knew very early on that this was who he was? We set this in the 1950s. He's pulling off this investigation. He knows that he's an alien, obviously, but we know it as well. The people around him in Hollywood, this would have been, if we set this in the past, during the McCarthy era, where everybody was paranoid about Russian spies, a show that does exactly this, by the way, at least in the flashback sequences, is the Fallout series, which just wrapped up recently on Amazon Prime. But imagine you're setting it in that same era, and Sugar is investigating and also hiding his identity. And maybe people don't think he's a space alien, although there were definitely crackpots who believed that back in the day. Maybe they just think he's a Russian spy. And then the metaphor between the space alien and the Russian spy is actually historical subtext to the actual films of the era. So all of that could be a very interesting way to explore this material. Alternately, if you feel that's been done too much, you can set it in a more contemporary time, and you could still, once again, be upfront about your twist. And here we have an alien who's pretending to act like a person, who loves movies because they teach him how to act like a person, and he falls in love with people through the movies. It's a metaphor for what we all do as film watchers, as TV watchers. And then maybe he gets hired by somebody who's nefarious, which may very well be the case as this plays out. And then that betrayal of him pretending to be something that he's not, and this person who hired him being not who they claim to be as well. That's interesting to explore these different layers of pretending. And of course, all of this in the context of Hollywood, where so much of this is about image and pretending. So many Hollywood film noirs are really about that, the illusion of the surface of Hollywood versus the reality. And once again, if on the surface we knew he was this alien, we knew he was trying to, or he believed he was on a mission to observe and maybe even assist these humans, only for him to discover that everyone around him is betraying him, that he's part of a bigger conspiracy. This ties in directly with these film noirs or paranoid thrillers from the 1950s. All themes, of course, that these show creators are fully aware of, it's right in the films that they select in referencing here throughout the course of this entire series. So my opinion up until this point, although there are components here that could be compelling, I think having this reveal so late in the season is a terrible mistake. I think revealing this in the third episode, for example, could have been interesting. And I really feel like they've dragged things out for this reveal so that maybe something can happen plot-wise in the last couple of episodes, which means that so much of the investigation up until now was just wheel spinning. For example, the entire Stallings subplot with the human trafficking and everything else, only for the guy to get killed off unceremoniously here in this particular episode. It's eaten up half the episodes up until this point. And all of the interpersonal dynamics within the Siegel family as well. When really at this point, the only thing we care about is why is this organization so interested in this Olivia person? And why have they chosen to abduct her? And basically, the first five episodes of the season can be thrown away. I'm sure there will be elements there. So when I say that, I am confident that there will be elements from there that will still be integrated into whatever happens at the end. But it's all become so secondary. Like literally everything we've watched up until this point becomes completely secondary to the real plot of the story. Why is Sugar's organization betraying him and abducting these people? And now we have only two 35-minute episodes left to explain all of this. I don't think we're going to see a second season of Sugar. Okay, so do you have a more generous read of the series than I do? If you've been watching up until this point, how do you feel about this twist? Drop me an email, needsomeintroduction@gmail.com. Follow me on Letterboxd. Check the show notes for the Letterboxd links. I'll be publishing some lists related to this episode. Comedic action rom-coms in honor of the Fall Guy film release. And on the Sugar side of things, some film noirs and other paranoid thrillers that are referenced directly in some of the film excerpts that we see throughout the course of this series of television. On the podcast next week, I'll have an episode where I have some capsule reviews of a bunch of the horror films we've seen so far this year. There's been a lot of them, not all great, but horror is a very variable genre. So there's probably something in there or a subset of the horror genre that appeals to you. And I actually find that to be one of the most interesting things about the genre itself, that people can love slasher movies, but hate science fiction, monster movies, or love monster movies and hate psychological thrillers. So I find it funny when people say they don't like horror, for example, when horror encompasses like 25 different genres. And I'll get into all of that, my interest and philosophy around horror, and some recommendations I have from the slew of horror movies we've seen this year. And there hasn't been really a breakout hit this year, but I do think that's going to change this summer. Also, Sona and I will be discussing Under the Bridge, the next episode, plus Sona will give me feedback on the other episodes, 3 and 4, that she saw this week. And there's actually a lot of content coming out. So check in middle of this week. Apple is trying yet again with another science fiction series, Dark Matter. And I'll be recapping the first couple episodes of that series. And probably in that same episode, be discussing a science fiction show on Apple TV that I think nobody's watching and should be watching. The very sweet and entertaining The Big Door Prize. So look forward to all of that. I'll talk to you soon.